a little bit about Moshe Rabbeinu, and that first scene in Parshas B'Shalach, which seems very unrelated to the overall tone and the overall pace and the overall word selection at the beginning of B'Shalach. B'Shalach is very triumphant. Uvenei Yisrael Yatsiru B'Yad Ramah Vahi B'Shalach Paro Asa'am Vanan Vamod Eish Laila Layim Moshe Amod Hanan. Everything is very, very exciting and loud and epic. And this is a passage we've been waiting for 200 years. And yet, something slows down the text. You always have to be careful to locate non sequiturs, parts that are inserted, implantations. And there is a textual implant here. Because right in the beginning of the parsha, let's read it together. Vayivishalach Paro Asam, Velo Nacham Elokim Derech Eretz Plishtim, Vayasev Elokim Asam Derech Yamsuf. So the voyage is beginning. And if you look at the end of the section, Vashem Holech Lifnehem Yomam Bamudanan Lekosamaderech Lo Yamisha Mudhanan. Right in the middle, there's this pasuk that has no purpose. It is not just purposeless, but it's also chronologically disjointed. Vayikach Moshe Asmos Yosef Imo Ki Hashber Hashbias Bnei Yisrael Emor Bakod Yifkod Elokim Eschem Valisem Asmosay Mizeitchem. This pasuk historically happened back in Bo. Because by B'Shalach, they're already in the desert. In Bo, they're leaving Ramses, they're traveling to Sukkot. If you're following the Prakim, it actually happened in the middle of Bo, because by the end of Bo, they're already far outside of Mitzrayim, they're in Sukkot, which is a desert encampment somewhere near Mitzrayim, but it's really not Mitzrayim proper. Yet somehow, the Torah takes this event of Moshe collecting Yosef's bones and inserts it right in the middle of B'Shalach. So it breaks the text, it breaks the chronology, the words are very different, and just to stress, it's a clumsy sentence, because as we say, it's a dangling modifier. Vayikach Moshe asmos Yosef imo ki hashpeh hashpia. Moshe didn't take a shvua. Yosef took a shvua. Okay, so we all know, obviously Moshe never took a shvua, but the language also stops the process. So why is this pasuk halting the flow and halting the voyage? You have to learn to find form matching substance and style matching substance. So what's the substance and how does the form help? And the answer is as follows, because you're seeing Moshe's, another trait of Moshe on display. Everyone's very busy that day. There's a lot of excitement. There's a lot of euphoria. People have a lot on their plate, scurrying around collecting the gold and silver and the clothing. You remember, they were like almost giddy over clothing, because in ancient Egypt, slaves had to walk around in public naked. It was part of dehumanization and humiliation. Remember, slavery is not just physical bondage, it's social discrimination, it's oppressive social hierarchies, it's generations that are born into slavery and born into inferiority complexes, looking at well-dressed and well-appointed Egyptian noblemen, and you're living in filth, and you're living in dirt, and you're living in grime, and your food is caked with dust, and you're not wearing clothing, and I always think about the Holocaust people who were not allowed to go to the bathroom when they were on work to take. You can imagine showing up for 14 hours and you have dysentery because you're eating bean soup and hard bread. So already your system isn't functioning. And anything you drink or eat is going to come out almost immediately. And you're not allowed to go to the bathroom. So within a couple hours, you've already soiled your pants. And then you have to spend 10, 12 hours smelling your own feces and suffering. So that's why the clothing were so important. That's why they took the smalot, right? Misharosam tsiros besimlosam al shechman. They didn't even get a chance to wear the clothing. It was still wrapped up on their shoulders. They took the bread and wrapped it up in their clothing. They didn't get a chance to try on the clothing. They didn't even know how to wear the clothing. So it's a combination of how quickly they left and not really knowing how to wear clothing, because they didn't wear clothing that often. So all of a sudden, everyone's very excited. Everyone's very giddy. Everyone's very lost, as they should be, because it's a very exciting day. They just witnessed their former tyrants, who they lived in fear of, being put in their place, being given the tune-up from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So this is a very exciting moment. And there's one person who's busier than anyone else that day. That's Moshe Rabbeinu, because he doesn't just have his own personal needs to attend to, but he's the man. Everyone's coming and asking him for guidance, and where should we go, and how quickly should we leave, and what are Hashem's interests, should we bake the bread, should we not bake the bread? And Moshe could very easily get lost in the moment and get lost in the distractions of the day. But someone has to think about Yosef. And it's a very pedestrian and heavy responsibility. No one wants to be spending their time. According to Chazal, Yosef's coffin had been submerged in a swamp. And someone had to go swimming in the swamp, or miraculously, of course, drawing the coffin out of the swamp. Either way, it's not the elegant part of the day. The elegant part of the day is collecting gold, silver, and loading your donkeys. No one wants to be burdened with this responsibility to go lug a coffin. And if anyone should be responsible, the last person in the world is Moshe. Because he doesn't even belong to Shevet Yosef. He belongs to Shevet Levi. This isn't even his grandfather. So you'd expect some member of the Yosef tribe, a Menashe person, an Ephraim person. But that's the point. Moshe does not get lost in the swirl and ignore the needs of the individual. Even though it's very easy sometimes to get lost in the larger calculus of what you're involved in, and sometimes you see that it comes at the cost of personal attention and individual attention and giving dignity and time to individual people, this is Moshe's excellence. Moshe's heroism is that one person who isn't even alive, who isn't even his blood relative, and it's his bones, is just as important as the mass, the 3 million, the miracles, history calling him. And he feels dirty. And that's why the Pasuk stresses, ki hashbeah hashbeah. And the dangling modifier almost makes it as if Moshe took the shvuah. Moshe didn't take the shvuah. Yosef forced others to make the shvuah, hashbeah hashbeah. It's a very clumsy phrase. But Moshe felt sworn to duty. Moshe felt that duty weighing heavily upon him. So he attended to it. And it speaks at once about living a life of duty, not being afraid of duty, not looking to delegate to other people, not looking to get away with as little as possible. If there's an issue to be taken care of, solve it. Deal with it. Don't wait for others. Don't delegate to others unless, obviously, you just simply can't perform the task. And the second part is not just the duty, to look at the Gemara source number base. Fascinating Gemara. The Gemara wants to know, can a Tamei Meis enter Machne Levia? A Tamei Meis can't enter Machne Shlina. But certain people who are Tamei have to leave all three Machnos, like a Mitzara. Some have to leave two Machnos, have to leave Machne Shlina, Machne Levia. What about someone who touched a dead body? He can't come into the base of Mikdash precincts, but can he stay in Machne Levia, which in the base of Mikdash was effectively Yerushalayim? You know the source that a Tamei Meis can remain in Machne Levia? Moshe Rabbeinu. Because Moshe Rabbeinu was effectively Tamei most of the time in the Midbar, and he obviously lived in Machne Levia. Why was he Tamei? Because he kept Yosef's bones on his body. Vayikach Moshe, the Gemara darshins, es atzmos Yosef imo. What does the Gemara say? My imo, source number base. Imo b'mechitzaso. He kept it with him. Now, whether Moshe was Tamei, obviously at the end of the base, Hamikdash doesn't mean he was a Tamei Mace most of the 40 years, or he just kept it in his room, and the Rai is not from Moshe, but from the actual Mace itself. There was much to be a Machne Levia, whatever. But it would have been very easy for Moshe to say, get these bones out of my face. I've got bigger things to deal with. I'm running a people, I'm running a nation, I'm walking up to Har Sinai. You know what, Sam? You take care of the bones. Okay, the Korman family, you, your children, your descendants, when we make it to Israel, we'll get the bones back from you. Just hold on to these for the trip. But Moshe doesn't delegate. It's an honor for him to personally attend to the duty of someone he never met. Are duties and responsibilities burdens? Do you want to try to get rid of as quickly as possible? Or duties and responsibilities honor, badges of honor? It's a whole different way to lead your life. Are you trying to get away with as little as possible? Escape responsibility? Escape commitment? Are you trying to embrace it and run towards it and shoulder it and be proud? I tell people, the first thing you do when you move to a community, and I don't mean your final community where you settle for 10, 15 years. I mean the first community you join that's not a large yeshiva-based community like Yeshiva Har Etzion or YU. Or next year, 2 years, you go to a college, all of a sudden you're joining a community. First thing you decide is, you go back to school, you go back to Strata. First thing you decide is, how am I going to contribute to my community? What responsibilities and tasks am I going to take? You're the Gabbai Sheni, you solve Shalosh Shittos, you're on the Adult Education Committee. You never want to be involved in an environment in which you're a taker without being a giver. That is a selfish, egotistical place to be. When I raised my kids, we had conversations about that. Why do you take out the garbage? Because you're part of this community. You share resources, you share the house, you share the fridge, you share the heat, you share the electricity. You take, you give. Now, when you're a kid, obviously, when you're a little kid, you don't give. And when you're an adolescent, you're not giving. You're not paying the electric bills. You're not paying the utility bills. But you give. You give decency. You give kindness. You give responsibilities, chores, tasks. Don't raise your kids without giving them tasks. You're not doing them a service. You're not doing them a favor. You think you're padding their environment, making it easier for them. You're not. You're training them to be takers without givers. That's a very, very toxic way to lead your life. And Moshe Rabbeinu's honor. It's my honor to be carrying this weight. I've carried weights in my life that I would have liked, in theory, not to have carried, because I would have liked them not to exist, but you carry weights, and you carry responsibilities. The second part of Moshe's heroism is, like I alluded to before, it doesn't get lost in the moment. How often have you felt the following feeling? That someone is looking at you, talking to you, but not really invested in you. You're standing in front of him or her, they're talking to you, but they're playing the crowd, they're looking at the crowd, they're shaking hands with the crowd. You feel as if you're a cardboard cutout. You're just there, but I felt that way before. I felt as if people who are not really, really invested in looking at me, making eye contact, talking to me, listening to me, I'm in that position all the time. And I work very, very hard not to get lost in the larger space and to pay as much attention and respect to every individual as Tzelem Elokim as I can. Sometimes I give a shiur, let's say. And after the shiur, in a public setting, several people line up to say hello, to ask questions, to wish a yeshkoach, to say the hate of the shiur, whatever. And one by one, I try as much as I can without being rude to not look at anyone else other than the person who's talking. Now, sometimes you can. A person will come over and interrupt in a polite way. I'm not saying in a very, very in an oafish way. They're going to say, okay, I just want to say a quick shop. It's good to see, whatever. So obviously you turn around, you pay attention, but you don't lose track of the person in front of you. And I know I felt terrible. I felt so, again, I don't feel inferior by the way people treat me, because self-esteem means you should be proud of yourself regardless of how people treat you. But I felt so ugly, not ugly in personal sense, I felt like so uncomfortable when people have treated me that way, when I'm in a public setting and I feel that people, who a lot of people know, are not really interested in talking to me. They're interested in maybe being seen with me, and looking at me while playing the crowd or looking around at the crowd. And Moshe's able to hone in, and I saw this in Rav Lechazin. Rav Lechazin was a honing inner. He honed in on the person at hand. I remember a situation a couple years ago, I think it was in South Africa, I forget where it was, but I'd given a shiur, and it was right after Shaul Shudas, and we were on the way to Maariv. An older woman was talking to me and sharing her thoughts and responding to me. And everyone was rushing me to Maariv because they wanted to say Baruch Hu. I said, I'll be there, start without me. And in that context, tefillah b'tzibur and saying Baruch Hu was not nearly as important as giving this woman kavod. If I would have ignored that woman or hastily dealt with her just to run off and say Baruch Hu, that wouldn't have been the correct decision. Because right now there's a person in this kavod abrios, and my responsibility is to attend to her kavod abrios, and to be there with her, and to listen, again, within reason. It's just, choose my ear off, and just attend to her. Talks endlessly, saying, I have to dive him out of now. But within reason, within the normal expectations of a conversation. Someone comes over to you, makes a comment, they expect you to respond, they have the right to respond back, and the normal flow of a conversation, if it ends up just dragging me down, then look, I got to get to the next situation. Everything within moderation, everything within balance. And you're seeing this in Moshe. And that's why this pasuk is inserted. Because Moshe is inserting his own being there, his mindfulness, his presence. He's not getting lost in Uvnei Yisrael Yatzu B'Yavrama. He's not getting lost in L'Yom Hoshanah. He's not getting lost with V'Hashem Holech Lefnehem. As far as he's concerned, there's only one person here. A dead person. His bones in a coffin. And there's a duty. He's going to perform it. He's going to cherish it. He's going to attend to it personally. And it doesn't stop there. Listen to this medrash. This is an incorrect medrash, unless you reinterpret it. Listen to this medrash. The medrash compares Yaakov's funeral procession, which is well attended. If you look back in Parshas Vayechi, Yaakov's funeral procession was attended by parashim and noblemen and chieftains
and then the locals in Eretz Yisrael gathered, Goren Hatad, so it was a public event. But that didn't come close to Yosef's funeral, because what attended, who attended Yosef's funeral? Let's see. Source number three, Velo Od. Shem Yaakov Alu Avde Paro, Vizikne Besa. A lot of important people. Im Yosef, who attended Yosef's funeral procession? Aaron, Vehashrina, Vehakonim, Vehalavim, Vechol Yisrael, Veshivim Anane Akavod. What? These were people attending Yosef's Levaya? The Konim, Levim, the Shechina, they're escorting Am Yisrael to Eretz Yisrael. They're not part of Yosef's Levaya. Yosef's just taking a trip. This is a hitchhiker. This is along for the ride. No. Because in one person's mind, through one person's eyes, this whole procession was about Yosef, in addition to Am Yisrael. In whose mind, in whose imagination? Moshe. Because for Moshe, Yosef was just as important as Am Yisrael, 600,000, 3 million. And all this glory, and the Anan HaKavod, and the Shechina, and the people, and the all of this, maybe Akiva will go shed some of the heat. Now we're getting too hot in here. Okay, maybe we'll lower it. Don't shed it, but lower it. And one thing we know, heat's working. Okay. Well, we know it really well. Okay. All this procession was for Yosef and not just for Am Yisrael. Okay? So that's the first lesson of Parshas B'Shalach. Don't let the larger, whether it's the larger environment, you're walking through a big place and you see a lot of friends. Think about camp. You walk into camp and all of a sudden a lot's happening, there's excitement. You're walking through a concert. Think about the situations you walk into where there's a real energy and something larger than yourself. And you then get swept up into that and you lose your center of gravity and where you are and your internal quiet. And sometimes I like being in these big settings and I say, you know what? I'm me. Nothing's going to shake me from where I am. I'm going to get swept away. I'm not going to get all intoxicated with the energy and the buzz. There are 50,000 people in the room, but I'm still in my own quiet space, and I know what my responsibilities are, and nothing's going to move me from that. Think about life, not just when you walk through situations. Think about when all of a sudden in life things accelerate. You have a lot of responsibilities in life, and you're taking tests, and you're, I don't know, getting married, daughter's getting, whatever. It's very easy to say, you know what? I'm so involved in so many things, I don't have time for you. Yeah, you sometimes have to say that because you have to distribute your time and invest your time. But never at the cost of the person in the moment in front of you that has a need. And even if you have to, it has to be with apology and sensitivity. Rather than, I find so many times that people who are overburdened and are lost in larger calculus, they just trample over human dignity and trample over human beings. And you're no longer there. You disappear in their world. And human beings should never, ever disappear in your world. I don't care if they're a Rosh Yeshiva. I don't care if they're a person, Jew, non-Jew, older, younger. If you're standing in the presence of a human being, respect and honor that human being. Doesn't mean you have to invest all your time and energy, but never turn human beings into vapor. Never turn human beings into invisible. Never make a person feel that they're invisible, that you don't see that they're there. Okay? Second issue of Parshas B'Shalach. Famous Rav Amital part. So get ready. They get to Mara, and obviously HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants to give them some practice mitzvahs to try on for size. Exhibition season. Exercise. Learn about mitzvahs. Learn about commandments. It's not easy. So what are the three commandments according to Chazal that Hashem delivers in Mara? Sham, Sam lo chok u'mishpat, v'sham nisam. Well, chok u'mishpat sounds like there's a nice blend between at least one pshat for chok u'mishpat. Chok u'mishpat mean many different things. But one dichotomy is chok is irrational, mishpat irrational. So Hashem gave them, according to Chazal, Shabbos. Makes a lot of sense, a ton of sense, that they should practice Shabbos before they advance to Har Sinai. That makes sense. How could you stand at Har Sinai without acknowledging Hashem as a Borei Olam? It doesn't make sense. Obviously, it's so deeply, deeply wired to Jewish identity. You can't imagine being at Har Sinai without already having Shabbos. So they have Shabbos, proto-Shabbos, pre-Shabbos. Okay, what else? Dinim. That makes sense. We see this in Parshas Yisro. You can't expect a ragtag bunch of former slaves in the state of anarchy to stand under Har Sinai to accept the Torah. It has to be a civil society, an organized society, people who respect law, people who respect each other, people who respect Moshe Rabbeinu's authority. So Dina, that makes sense. What's the third mitzvah? Thanks again. What's the third mitzvah that they're given? Let's see the Medrash. Sham sam lo chokum mishpat, Rashi. Bemara, nasan lem mixus parshio shel Torah, she's asku bohem. Shabbos. Para Aduma? Are you kidding me? Para Aduma? They didn't have a Mishkan to process Para Aduma. No one was Tameh and needed Para Aduma. Because before Har Sinai, Tuma didn't exist. Shabbos, they could sink their teeth into. Let's practice Shabbos. And they did. To greater success or lesser success, as we see some people violated the first Shabbos in Olish with the man. They left the tents, they collected money, tried to collect money. Dinan, they already started to practice. Parshas Yisro. Paraduma. They didn't have access to cows. They didn't have access to Haramishcha, we have to shech the animal. They weren't Tameh. What's going on? They didn't have Konim yet. There's no Beis HaMikdash yet. They can go wherever they want. Why of all the mitzvos is Hashem delivering Paraduma? So to answer this question, Rav Amital told us the story. As the Gemara recounts of Dama ben Asina and Kiddush Laman Aleph, and you all know the story. Let me repeat the story. One day, Dama ben Asina discovers Avnei HaShoam. What are Avnei HaShoam? These huge gemstones that were inserted on top of the shoulders of the Kohen in this little apron called the Me'il, or not the Me'il, the Ephod, excuse me, an apron harness. And the Avnei HaShoam rested upon his shoulders and held the Choshen in place. So the Choshen had four corners to it, and there were harness to his body, and straps ran up the Choshen to these heavy stones, which kept it in place. Now these gemstones were very, very pricey. The gemstones of the Choshen, okay, you can find them here or there, local peddlers. But these huge, big stones, the Avnei HaShoam, they're expensive, they're rare. One day this guy, this Gentile, in Ashkelon, came by these two stones, or his father, Nesina. And the Gemara in Kiddushin talks about Dama, his son, Dama ben Nesina, and his commitment to Kibbutz Avaim. Just to show how central Kibbutz Avaim is, that even Gentiles succeed in it. You don't need to be commanded towards Kibbutz Avaim. And of course, the inverse is also true. Commandments don't help. Kibbutz Avaim is one of the mitzvahs that you need to see in the flesh. It's almost impossible to excel in Kibbutz Avaim if you don't see role models. So if you've seen role models in life, great. If you haven't, pay attention, because they'll come into your world. Not necessarily in your family all the time. But you see, it's simply a mitzvah that's impossible to perform from the Shulchan Aruch, because the emotions are too charged, and the relationships are too complex, and the responsibilities are too all-pervasive. You can read the Shulchan Aruch from Hein Pizmer, from day till tomorrow. It's not going to help you. You need to have people. Oh, I saw how Rav Lichtenstein honored his father. I'm going to try to do the same. I saw these people. That's to be tzaddikim. I saw these people, right? Who excels in Kibbutz Avaim and Sefer Bereishis? Esav. Who fails? Through no fault of his own? Yaakov. So all the calculus is off. You can be the biggest Rasha and excel in Kibbutz Avaim. You can be the biggest tzaddik, and for whatever reason, you don't get to it. So don't think you can learn out of a Shulchan Aruch. You have to find people, and that's what Chazal was saying. Look, I told you guys many times, don't be afraid to be inspired by moral courage in people who aren't firm or aren't Jewish. If anything, ironically, sometimes it's easier to be inspired by the moral courage because you see them operating without religious responsibility. Like tonight, when I'm going to try to be a good husband, okay, Rabbi Tarragon, he's an Oved Hashem, he knows Yaftarecha Kamocha, he's just being kind to his wife because of the mitzvah. Whereas when you see someone that doesn't fulfill mitzvahs and they're still morally, he's, oh, you know, that's interesting. Where does that come from? Why does that person show such moral devotions, moral courage? Evidently, there's something called morality. And Hashem incorporates it within halacha, so I better be more careful about it, more dedicated. So you're going to go through the next couple of years, you're going to meet some impressive people. Those of you who will serve in the army, Bezos Hashem, you'll meet some really impressive people, who are patriotic and dedicated and committed. Those, oh, they're not firm, I can't grow from them. Some of you will go to university. You'll meet professors. Don't at all, be attracted to how smart they are. I could care less how smart you are. And you should care less how smart they are. It doesn't mean anything, and it will get you nowhere in life. Try try to look at people if you can, see who are they as people. Sometimes you can, just walk in and give a lecture. But I remember in college, I remember the three or four professors that I was able to like look behind the curtain and say, this is a really dedicated, kind, committed, idealistic person. I want to sit in that person's class. I don't need that person to teach me information. I get that from books. I like sitting in classes with people, someone I just want to look at for an hour a week or 3 hours a week and just try to get a sense of who, the class also has to be meaningful. You can just sit in a room, look at someone. I remember being inspired by people. And not just in my university. I meet people all the time, read about people all the time. I find them inspiring. So the Gemara in Kiddushin tells us to look at Dama ben Asina as the role model, the paradigm of Kibbutz Avayim. So what happens? He has these Avnei HaShoam. They're worth, for argument's sake, $1 million. The people from the Beis HaMikdash, the Machon HaMikdash people, come by and say, please sell them to us. We've got $100, got some suitcases. Here we are. Bring the suitcases. What's the problem? Dama's father, Nesina, is taking a shluff. And he's sleeping on the key that has the key to the safe that has these gemstones. Now, I want everyone to listen carefully, even Gabi and Gabe, who's falling asleep. This is the one Gemara in Shas I order you not to listen to, not to follow. Dama says, I can't sell you the gemstones. My father's sleeping. I don't want to wake him up. I'm speaking to you on behalf of all the fathers in the world. We want to be woken up. Okay? If I'm sleeping and someone's bringing suitcases, please wake me up. I'm sloughing in base matters. All of a sudden, like, my kids wake me up for the last 30 years about all Narishkeit. No? Oh, all of a sudden, I'm asleep. Okay? So I tell you, your parents don't want you to fulfill this Gemara. Go back to sleep. Okay? Someone comes with suitcases, brings truck, ready to download. Abba, wake up, okay? Take me, pull me by the toenails, pour water on me. I'm happy. I'll get some sleep later. Whatever. Dama ben Asina, I'll be sleeping. I'll pass. Now, we know that part of the story, most of us. But the story continues. I'm paraphrasing, read the Gemara. The next year, what did he discover? Paradum. Now, all of a sudden, contract was max contract. Not $1 million, $10 million. Paraduma level contract. Paraduma max contract. And they're coming not just with suitcases. They're coming with tractor trailers full of cash. Full of GWs. Full of George Washington's. And they're down there. Here you go. And he says, you know what? I know that I could take this tractor trailer of $10 million. I don't want it. Just pay me the money I lost last year. Last year, dad was sleeping, passed on a mill. Give me a mill, you'll get the paraduma. What's going on here? What's Dama ben Asina bargaining here? And more importantly, whatever it was going through his mind, let's say he was drunk, whatever. Why is the Gemara quoting this? Okay, Dama ben Asina made a mistake. He was bargaining down rather than bargaining up. Okay, you know, it was a comedic skit, whatever. Okay, maybe give me less. Might want to give you more. But why do we care? Why is this important? Ravalin tells us the answer is as follows. Dama ben Asina was a man of integrity. Dama ben Asina said, in my religion, I get rational based mitzvahs. It makes sense to perform acts and rituals that are logical, that have symbolism. Kibbutz Avayim makes sense to me. Paraduma doesn't. My religion doesn't account for irrational mysteries. There's no ration to the fact that burnt ashes from a red cow should alleviate tumor. Not only is it irrational, but it's an enigma within the irration, because the person officiating becomes tamei, and the recipient becomes tar. So I can wrap my head around irrational, but when it's internally inconsistent, that makes it even more puzzling. So Dama says, you know what? I have to be true to my integrity, to my moral compass. I have to be true to my conscience. I believe that I deserve money for Kibbutz Avayim. Last year, I went to the mat for Kibbutz Avayim. Last year, I sacrificed for Kibbutz Avayim. Kibbutz Avayim money I deserve because it makes sense to me. Because I believe in religion pivoted on ration. But Paraduma money, I don't deserve. I can't honestly take Paraduma money because I don't believe in the irrational. And I can't make sense of the irrational. So I'm being honest. He was an honest guy. I deserve the money I forfeited last year on behalf of Kibbutz Avayim, but I don't deserve the price tag of Paraduma.
And that's why the Gemara is quoting this story. And the purpose of the story is that unlike Dama ben Nesina, we do have a religion that's a hybrid of parts that we understand and parts that we'll never understand. And you have to break out of this rational shell where reality is determined by the limits of your own cognition. It's humiliating, and it will trap you. You have a brain, you have a processor, you have the ability to intellectualize. They're all God-given. Don't abandon them. Today there's a counter-movement, anti-intellectualism, where the greatest curse you can... Oh, you're an intellectual? Thank you. That's a compliment. It's a compliment to be someone that uses their brain and develops their brain. It's a compliment to be intellectual. It may be dangerous to follow intellectualism. And these are just terms I'm making up, where the primary driver of human identity is information and brain. That's ridiculous. Sadly, many of the people in Zoom are trying to climb out of that trap because you were trapped for 4 years in high school. Everyone feeded you with awards because of how great your scores were. Like, who cares? Who cares? It's just a technical advance to a better job. It's important. I care. It's important. But that's not the end of identity. The purpose of identity is not scores on tests. The purpose of identity is much, much deeper. Remember, I told you, eliminate valedictorians. Be the greatest thing to do in every school. Because it creates a mirage that that's the ticket to success. And it's not. It will not get you anywhere in life. I know a lot of very, very smart people who lead very, very sad lives because they don't have relationships and they don't have identity and they don't have meaning and they don't have virtue, they don't have nobility. It's all just information swirling around in your head. You don't want to get trapped there. On the other hand, you want to be able to use your brains, obviously. Jim gave you this gift, and wasting your brain is a terrible, terrible crime. And unfortunately, as I keep telling you, we're spiraling in this world away from thinking and away from analysis in a way. I think it's healthy that in the Orthodox world there's a shift towards experientialism and a shift towards Hasidus, that the Hasidus is not intellectual. I think it's all, but because it answers a need that possibly isn't being served, fantastic, but not to the point that we're going to vilify thinking and reading and processing, God forbid. But you're not going to get everything in religion. You're not going to understand everything. As you grow older, you'll understand more and more. But there are parts of Avodas Hashem you just won't get. And there are parts of history you won't get. Mirtz Hashem, we should have an easy time in this country, and we should continue to... Unfortunately, we suffered a tragedy last week. Who knows what the future holds? You're not going to always make sense of the world around you. Your grandparents lived in a much darker world. The world made less sense to Holocaust survivors, and they persisted, and they faced the mystery, and they faced the big question marks. And faith has to run so deep that it emboldens you and empowers you with belief and with commitment, even in the face of the indecipherable. And once they asked Reb Lichtenstein to define the Emunah to us, and he said, you should be capable of being the last Jew to walk out of Auschwitz alive, namely the last Jew on this earth, and not have the foundation of faith disturbed. What does it mean? How can Hashem do this? And what sense does it make? And again, we don't judge anyone who lost their faith in the Holocaust, because never judge anyone in general, and certainly not until you walk the mile in their shoes. So to live through that nightmare is almost inconceivable, indescribable. But looking forward, trying to build your religious identity, faith has to come before reason. Commitment has to come before cognition. Say, I'm accepting the masara my parents gave me. I'm accepting the masara my rabbein gave me. I'm belonging. Each person, no one's trying to shape your identity. Your identity is going to be yours, but this is the framework within which your identity should be shaped. These are the values. These are the mitzvahs. These are the commitments. And then go decide how you want to dress and what profession you want to choose, who you want to marry. There's room for personal expression, but it has to start with faith. And if you're still waiting to understand why before you invest in, and there are kids in yeshiva who never really crack that barrier, who never really get into learning, never really get into religious passion because it doesn't make sense to them. And they're waiting for it to make sense because we've been trained not to commit or invest in something until it makes sense to us. And the real way to experience life with some things are just to invest based on trust, and then it will make sense. You have to somehow invest massively in something, and then it will make sense. And the problem is, of course, we are suffering a crisis of trust. That's, if you want to wheedle it down, why is it so hard today to be firm? Because the ticket to firmkeit, to religious passion is, unlocks the door and unlocks the trap is, I trust. I trust my parents.
I trust the Masara, I trust Merit, whatever. Why do we suffer trust? A million different reasons. But we suffer a lack of trust. So people are sitting there solitary, lacking belonging, thinking about religion, trying to make sense of it at 18, trying to make sense of it at 16. Baruch Hashem, you're all smart guys. You've made sense of it, but you still have a lot to grow, and you still have a lot to discover, and you still have a lot. So at some point, you just have to either, consciously or subconsciously. I think at a certain point, when I met Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, I subconsciously gave up. I said, you know what? I don't need to decipher it all. There's this great person. I remember him telling me about the Rav. And the way he described the Rav was the way I saw Rav Lichtenstein. I saw Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. I couldn't imagine meeting someone of that caliber or of that exquisite excellence. And then he described Rav Soloveitchik in his eyes the way I saw Rav Aaron. And he told me that Rav Soloveitchik told him about Rav Chaim. And they went, so all of a sudden, I've got Rav Aaron cubed to a square. So I gave up. I don't have to have all the answers. There's something here that's drawing me, and I'm willing to believe. And suspending your rational decision and taking great leaps of faith and believing in something you don't know and can't prove, those are the most redeeming choices in life. Because that's the only way you cross the canyon of doubt. To get to the next side, to do great things in life, you have to enter the territory of the unknown. If you always remain in your safety zone, you'll always remain mediocre. You'll always follow a charted path and a formula. To be great, you have to go somewhere without knowing what that other territory is. It's just definitional. It's built in. If you want to have a safe and comfortable life, just follow the orders and follow the instructions, and you'll get this job. And remember, I worked for IBM in 1986. It took me about 2 weeks to realize this is not the place for me. I was on a really, really high, sophisticated staff. We built an internet like 8 years, 10 years before the internet. We connected like really, really smart people. I said, my goodness. This is just a house of mediocrity. It's like you stay, you follow orders, you respect your boss. Every 3 years, you get a 3% raise. I said, not for me. I'm out. I'm not going to work for a company that places me into, that basically steals my excellence and my dreams for security. Don't dream. Don't do anything different. Don't rock the boat. We'll give you a 3% increase. Whoa. No way. They didn't say it, but it took me like a day to smell it out. I looked at the other people around me. That's all they wanted. I said, no, this is not Michael. Michael doesn't want that. Walk right out the door. You don't want that. Now, how do you do that? How do you cross? How do you make Aliyah? How do you join the army? How do you get married? How do you find religious passion? How do you throw yourself into something that you can't make sense of? It's not just mitzvahs you don't understand. It's decisions. At a certain point, you just have to find people you trust and say, okay, they will take me across that canyon. They'll walk me across the bridge. I trust that person. He's recommending it. I'm just going to do it. Those are the redeeming decisions in life. That is why Rav Amital said, in Mara, we were given paradigma. Because we had to get accustomed to non-rational mitzvahs. We could not develop religious orientation and religious preparedness for Har Sinai if we hadn't tried on an illogical mitzvah, at least to discuss it and think about it, and think about it because we can understand it, but embrace the concept of not understanding something and submitting to Hashem. That's why at Mara, they were given Shabbos, they were given Dinim, but they were also given Paraduma. And Rav Amital actually told us that when Gerim would consult with him, converts, candidates for conversion, he would tell them, practice three mitzvahs, based on this Rashi in Mishalach. Shabbos, obviously, every Ger, don't keep Shabbos, obviously, because Shabbos Chayim Misa, but practice Shabbos and do one Isser, so you're not keeping full Shabbos. And something that makes sense. You're not necessarily dinim, because how is a ger going to practice it? It's not a court, and it's just some other mitzvah that makes sense. And he said, choose, you're not paraduma, because again, we don't have paraduma today, but choose a mitzvah that doesn't make sense. Yishatn is, whatever. A mitzvah that makes sense, a mitzvah that doesn't make sense, and Shabbos. And they'll have a package that prepares you. And that's what happened in Mara. This is, what I just told you, is one of the fundamentals of religious identity. Everyone's got to find their calibration between the two. But don't get caught in that trap that reality can only be what's mediated by human intelligence and human cognition. That is the seductive whisper of modernity. We've advanced so far in science and so far in technology and so far in reason and so far in enlightenment that people are trapped assuming that empirical reality is the only reality. The reality is beyond. Don't give up your empirical. Don't give up your rationalism.
Don't give up your intellectual ability, but there's so much more than experience mediated through intellectual growth or intellectual analysis. Okay, since we have one more minute left, let's talk a little bit about what Yeshiva and Haritzion is based upon. Okay, the third most important conversation tonight, but an important conversation. I talked about this earlier today with Mashiach. We'll just spend a few minutes. Yeshua turns to Moshe and says, let's find some warriors. But he uses a strange word. Source number three, Bechar lanu anashim, choose people for us. What do you mean Bechar lanu anashim? The Mechilta asks, Lama Yeshua, line number two, source base, Bechar li anashim. Yeshua said, choose people for me. Officers, generals, fighters, I'm running the show. I'm Moshe Rabbeinu. Bechar lanu? The answer is, he's empowering Yeshua. We're in this together. And from this statement, Bechar lanu anashim, give me the secret of parenting here. Secret of parenting, secret of being rebbing. From this Chazal say, source number base, source number gimel, Mikan, she talmud chaviv lifnei rabbo kimosa. Or, as Medrash Avos Rav Nosson says, source gimel, hi kvo talmidcha chaviv alecha kishulcha. Here's the challenge of chinuch. Enlightened chinuch. The chinuch you think of. I'm in position of authority. I have a system of ideas that I want you to accept. Hopefully you respect me. I have two ways. I could either respect you and your individuality and your dignity and try as I can to display passion, commitment, sacrifice, while still not just respecting you as a person, but trying to empower you to become great. Or I could submit and submit it all upon you and impose it all upon you and be heavy-handed and annihilate you and extinguish you and make you less. Because in the end of the day, religious education is submission. At the end of the day, we're telling you, how can you submit to ideas? But sometimes submission becomes extinction, where you extinguish yourself. And some teachers and some rabbis especially create that process. Again, it doesn't last long because at some point you wake up and say, I don't want to be extinguished. I'm my own person. I want to be great. I want to be myself. I want to have my own voice. I want to have my own. That's the sweet spot that we try to occupy here in Yeshiva. And that's why when we succeed, and with some of you we are succeeding, some of you not so, when we succeed, the success is legendary. Because we're trying to empower you. We're trying to build up your identity. We're trying to respect and honor you as people. And part of honoring you is I don't want to indoctrinate you, because when I indoctrinate you, I take away your freedom of conscience and freedom of thought. I don't trust you to make decisions. Okay, these are words you've thought about, but I'm trying to describe it to you in educational terms. You're human beings. You have divine image. You have freedom of conscience. You have dignity. How can I take all those and fortify them? Make you feel them even more, that you're your own person. And still attach certain values and passion to you. And I'm sure some of you, not all of you, probably have met rabbanim and educators who don't, which is a much more aggressive and doctrinal, and this is the way, and then you feel less about yourself. Okay, it's a curse, though. You're trying to find that median range. Even in this issue, I'm sure you could probably compare me to other rabbanim. I don't know how it'd come out. I didn't follow the poll or something, but like in the next poll or something, who's the most honoring rabbi? Who's the lesser? But we're all trying to get to this. And it's not easy. And you can move, and it's the same thing with raising children. Whenever you're in a position of authority, how do you, on the one hand, impose the authority, impose the rules, impose the values, right? Parenting is not just whatever goes. Everyone can make their own decision. Parenting is you're steering the ship. There are rules, there are expectations, there are values, there's a masara. But if you shrink identity, then you eliminate dignity, and you essentially diminish people's talent and personality. In the end, even if you're successful, it's almost as if it doesn't become internalized. For something to be truly internalized, it has to be congruent with growth and with expansion and with the development of identity. Even when you accept it, you say, it doesn't become fully organic. You listen to the rabbis, and you become your own person. And then there are two yous. There's the firmkeit you receive from your rabbis or your parents, and there's the you. And then you bring out that you in some other context. And when it sticks, it's magical. I've been doing this long enough. When it sticks and we're able to hit that spot where we honor you as Talmidim, I mean, honor you, we bow down to you, but we honor you as Talmidim, then you become great. The challenge for you is, that's a challenge for me. The challenge for you is the next line. What's the next line in the Mishnah and Avos? Okay. Or the next line in the Mechilta? Line number two from the bottom. Uminayin shemora rabo kimara shemayim. It's hard for me to say this. It's hard for a rabbi to tell you you should honor me. I don't want your honor. It would be bad for my ego. And even if I did, let's say I did want your honor, it would be uncouth for me to say you should honor me. But you have to honor. Because if you don't honor people and revere people, then you're going to lose out. And there were rabbis in Europe who were much more aggressive in getting Talmidim to honor them. Rav Goldberg, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, of Yeshivas Keren Biavim, the founding of Rosh Yeshiva, a famous story. Once he's giving a shir kolli, based medrash, he asked for a cup of water. I never heard Rav Aaron ask for a cup of water. In a million years, he wouldn't ask. He'd rather dive stuff. He asked for a cup of water. A boy brought up a pitcher and a cup. The boy went back to the seat. He said, "Now come back up and pour it for me." Now we think that's no. He was teaching the boy to honor him, or to honor the Masara through him. Here in this yeshiva, because we're so attentive to that first part, so we don't impose that honor on you and that mora rabbah. We don't sit up front in ties and jackets and hats and see a rebbeim and we're the rebbeim and here's the roster and we are. But you're going to lose out on that other part, and you have to find a way to see in us, without us wanting it or promoting it, that element of mora rabbah kumar shemayim. And it doesn't. Remember, I'll just tell you one story. Rav Lichtenstein. He never let us serve him. Now, when you serve a Rebbe, that's part of Mara Rabbah. Why am I serving him? Why am I? Because he represents the Masara. By serving him, I'm part of something larger. And we were having a tug of war at the end of Shir. We said, Rebbe, and I said to him, someone else said, Rebbe, don't you understand, by not letting us be Mishamesh you, you're depriving us of Shemesh Tamei Chachamim. And he looked at us and he said, I know, but I can't. So it was a very honest moment. That in his constitution, he just couldn't allow himself to be served. Now, again, Rav Aaron, in his state, that made sense. If you asked me to carry him, I said, no, I can't. That would be false piety. Because I'm not at that level. So I'm happy if you want to take my svarim, whatever. Because it's your piety has to be balanced, has to be appropriate for where you are. All of a sudden, you start acting. So people take all these Gedolim stories and they adopt all the Gedolim's behavior. It's just, it's off. It doesn't fit where they are. So, you know, where you are, and find the Avodas Hashem that's organic, that makes sense for you, rather than pantomiming people's firmkeit, which is it's exhibitionist and it's grandstanding and it's showy. Just be authentic, be real people. I think there's a lot of authenticity in this room, in this building. People trying to be real people and talk to you, real people, and quite frankly, train you to be real people. And that's a great trait in life, to be real, and to know who you are, and to not have to play roles and take on faces and take on masks and. But it's hard, and I know it's a problem. I've been through that, because I know my rebbeim were so humble and so deferring. And they didn't. Okay, I had it easier because I had a person who was just so celestial, so otherworldly, that he came into the room and just, you know, of course, the world stopped when he walked into the room. Everything stopped. Unfortunately, you don't have them. I'm trying to be honest with you. We're not those people, and we don't hold ourselves as those people. But we're doing our job to the best that we can. We're going b'char lano and Hashem. We're honoring you and preserving your integrity and your independence. How can I don't have an easy answer to this, because thank God I don't have any. If I had an easy answer, I'd be an egotist. It's, oh, it's very easy. Honor become. I don't, because I don't see myself that way. But your struggle in life is to try to find Rabbanim, maybe in this issue, maybe others. You say, oh, I remember. I'll just end with this story. One of the boys in yeshiva who left Gush after three years, and he went to Neri Yisrael, like, long time ago. I said, how's Neri Yisrael? Tell me about Neri Yisrael. He said, oh, when Tzvi Berkowitz walks into the room, I lose my breath the same way I used to lose it when Rav Aaron walked into the room. I said, I'm happy. Because in a world of cool, young, back-tapping Rabbanim will play ball, and we're not creating that lose your breath walk. We're creating a religion without awe. And religion without awe is grounded and is not transcendent,
And non-transcendental religion is flat. There has to be something higher. And you have to allow yourselves to be lifted into something higher. And the way you lift something higher is to see great people and to have awe. Whether here or other, you need to see great people that take your breath away. And that's hard to do both. And we shade it one way. I imagine someone can walk into this room right now and say, you're getting it wrong. You're being too protective of Kavod Talmidim. You're giving them too much space. You should wear a jacket and a tie. You should all sit in front, and the Rebbeim should, and the Talmidim should all speak to you in third person. I don't agree with that, but that would be a fair argument, because it's right in the space that we're trying to calibrate. Okay, let's go down the map. This will be a little bit of a walk.